Thank you, Greg, and thank you for the invitation to this meeting, to Tim in particular, who has been the engine behind this global health initiatives for quite some time. This is another of the one-day shots that we get every year. We hope to continue on this line. I think it's important. Good morning to everybody. I'm going to address the issue of rethinking trauma as a global health challenge. I will address this issue in an outline that I am presenting to you, looking first of all at violence as a public health problem and global violence-related deaths and the issue of psychological trauma, which is the central issue with which we are working in a global scale. Also, I have some ideas to share with you about trauma and recovery and what are the emerging controversies in this field. A word on complex emergencies, which is a kind of a new entity that it, or construct that is coming up in recent years. A critical review of what humanitarian interventions are this far, and a brief presentation, hopefully at the very end, on the trauma and global health program which I lead. As a reminder to some of you, maybe it's interesting to try to define violence in some way, so we know what we are referring to. It is a very broad term which has been used and misused. And this is the intentional use of physical force or abuse of power or intimidation, threatened or actual against oneself, another person, group, community, or nation, that either results in or has a high likelihood of resulting in injury, trauma, death, psychological harm, deprivation, and long-term disability, or poor development outcomes, that may compromise the health and well-being of individuals, of families, of communities, and entire nations, affecting always the integrity of the social tissue. This is a kind of revised definition or updated definition of the WHO in 2002, which I find interesting because it leads me to the subject of violence, which has become the worldwide leading cause of death for people aged 15 to 44. External causes, in fact, is ranking fourth in the worldwide causes of death after cancer, infectious diseases, and cardiovascular diseases. And this is a relatively recent phenomenon. Two-thirds of this total death toll is caused by non-intentional violence, for instance, traffic accidents. Non-intentional violence is easier to prevent and control, which is not the case of the one-third of the death toll, which is intentional violence. And this one-third is growing in the last few years because of the many conflict areas that we are confronted with, particularly in Central Asia and Central and Sub-Saharan Africa. Suicides, homicides, and organized violence, terrorism, wars, and armed conflict, genocide, and ethnic cleansing are the engines behind this one-third death toll of intentional violence. A quick review of the estimated global violence-related deaths points at... Let me see if I can put this here. The type of violence divided into the three categories that I referred to, and we're talking here of intentional violence, homicide, suicide, and war-related, it is interesting to see that out of the total of 1.6 million, which is obviously an underestimated number, but this is what we have this far, about half of those deaths are suicide. So this speaks to violence against yourself as a growing concern in most countries. Another feature that I want to show you is the importance that out of the total 1.6 million, 91% of this total death toll is in low and middle-income countries. So this is an asymmetric distribution of death due to violence, and the high-income countries, in fact, have a very much smaller proportion. If we now look at the homicide and suicide rates, breaking down by age groups, and this is global figures again per 100,000 population, we can see that homicide rate is becoming very important and significant in the 15 to 60 and plus age group of men, and similarly suicide has a very important proportion of this homicide-suicide rates per 100,000. The group over 60 is in men and also in women are also important figures that we have to take into account. In total, when we talk about traumatic injuries, it's been estimated that annually there is about 4.2 million annual deaths due to traumatic injuries. And it's more than 20 million people that's estimated will remain with some trauma-related sequela and disabilities caused by violence and diverse external causes. This is increasing exponentially over the last few years, and we will see this a little bit more later in the presentation. The distribution of this trauma, as we know it, has both a geographical asymmetrical distribution and also an asymmetric social distribution, which means that trauma is not an event that happens at random. So, you know, it tends to be concentrated in certain geographical areas in particular. If you take, for instance, homicide, this is one of the rates that's very high in certain urban environments in Latin America, namely Medellin in Colombia and Rio in Brazil, are two good examples of two leading cities where the homicide rate is the number one cause of death of men between 15 and 44. If you take non-intentional trauma, for instance, in like traffic accidents, is Eastern Europe, the area of the world that is with the highest numbers in this respect. So that is a geographical distribution which is uneven. And it also, there are a number of factors that tend to be correlated, if not to some extent, determining the presence of trauma. And this is poverty, urbanization, rapid urbanization and rapid population growth, illiteracy, forced migration and displacement, gender issues, and social inequalities. I took this from a recent number of The Economist that maybe some of you have seen in January this year, which presents an interesting view, a global view, for this global health seminar, of what is the so-called fail states, namely Congo and Myanmar and Afghanistan, and the so-called critically weak states in lighter green colors here. The superimposition of the image leads us to realize that the main drug trafficking drugs routes, which are depicted all over the globe, for opium production, are here in Myanmar and Afghanistan, while the main cocaine production areas and trafficking routes are in South America, and once again in countries such as Colombia and Peru and Bolivia, where the levels of violence and political violence, for the case of both Colombia and Peru up to recent times, have been extremely high. This is an interesting and very suggestive geography of violence, or landscape of violence, that we are looking at here, and the war-related deaths, which are obviously concentrating in countries such as Congo, which has the highest rate of deaths due to violence-related deaths, and political deaths also in all this region of Central and South Saharan Africa. What I'm going to talk for the rest of this presentation is of the hidden part of this iceberg that we have seen. And this is not physical trauma, but it is psychological trauma. Victims of violence of intentional origins are at increased risk for a wide variety of psychological and behavior-related problems. PTSD is the most obvious one, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, alcohol abuse, anxiety, suicidal behavior, STDs, and HIV/AIDS are some of the problems that we usually encounter in those regions that have been most affected by extreme violence and for sustained periods of time, or protracted violence, as we call it. Some of them, the failed states that I just shown, and some other quasi-failed states in the past. Natural catastrophes and complex emergencies of unintentional origins also have poor mental health outcomes, and these are often ignored or not well attended. Today, psychological trauma, in short, could be seen as a co-production of very many sectors involved, such as defense and security, justice, and health and social security, education, the private sector, the pharmaceutical corporations are a good example, or is a good example, that was shown this morning in the key lecture speaker. Pharmaceutical corporations not only are designing drugs for new diseases, but they are now designing new diseases for the drugs that they are producing. And I think much of the trauma-related disorders have been much designed by laboratories and pharmaceutical corporations who are very interested in opening the market for antidepressants or any other psychotropic drugs. Traumatic events have far broader, more varied and complex meanings and effects than those recognized by conventional nosology and psychiatric practice. And these effects evoke a wide range of culturally specific coping and adaptive strategies that are still poorly understood. In fact, the social, the political, and the cultural realities that we live in today's world structure the context in which violence is collectively experienced and determine, to a large degree, greater or lesser, the subjective meaning of violence and traumatic events, the way in which distress is experienced and always is reported by the populations who have been affected by violence. It also determines the coping strategies and the type and extent of social support that's available to manage, and to we know that social support is very much determinant or a risk factor the density of the social support network is a very much of a risk factor in the presence of PTSD. Individuals with very strong ties to the immediate group and to the community at large and with a very dense social network do have much lower rates of PTSD than those who do not have a very rich social support network. It also determines the type of responses, including therapies that are available and that are considered appropriate and effective. Let's look at some of the controversies around trauma and recovery. There seems to be consensus in the academic world and in the scientific community of the direct consequences of exposure to traumatic experiences. I've shown much of that in the first part of the presentation in terms of mortality, but also of increased disability, morbidity, and so on, including the presence of trauma and PTSD symptoms found in diverse cultural settings. However, in spite of that consensus, there is a emergence of new controversies, and there is a lack of consensus in some other elements associated with violence and trauma. One of them is which are the residual, the very long-term effects which could be attributable to sustained exposure to violence. We know not very much on this. Second, how trauma effects tend to fade away with the passing of time. The disappearance of, or the slow reduction, or the proportional reduction that PTSD, for instance, is experienced in people who have been subject to a personal criminal assault are different from people who have experienced a rape, for instance. And that PTSD, however, is reduced over time, even without any intervention. We know little about why is this reduction occurring. We know now that partly the mechanisms of traumatic memory are very involved into this disappearance or fade away of PTSD, but still there is something that we not understand very well. Other questions where there's little agreement is why some people exposed to violence develop PTSD symptoms while others remain apparently healthy. And this is a central question that challenges the causality and the linear model of trauma, that exposure to violence will generate a universal response in most subjects exposed to this violence as PTSD symptoms. And this has been challenged for the evidence in the literature with proofs, which is very controversial. There are studies that shows that the enormous variability in the PTSD of those people exposed to extreme violence and extreme violent effects, such as the 9/11 in the United States. There were a number of studies conducted after that traumatic event, and there is great disparities as to the those who have been exposed, either directly or witnesses to the falling of the towers in 9/11 in New York, and those who were simply exposed by the imaging of televisions over months, transmitting those worldwide. And there's a new kind of PTSD entity called virtual PTSD that is coming up in the literature, which has been also a matter of concern. So how do the effects of massive trauma exposure, for instance, genocide, could differ from a single traumatic episode, for instance, criminal assault? And those differences are important to explain, and we don't have a good paradigm or a good hypothesis to follow. And finally, how are these the existing paradigms for helping individuals, families, and communities manage and cope with adversity? And how can these paradigms be adapted to different social and cultural contexts? Finally, how effective are the existing therapies for trauma-related disorders? This is a question that has been partially responded by a report that I am going to refer in a minute. A report made by the Institute of Medicine in the United States. There is a lack of consensus in the final analysis, or a controversy, as to 2 points. First, the public health value of PTSD, as of the PTSD construct, which according to some is of very little value to make it operational. And the second is, which are the most effective interventions for use in the immediate and the midterm post-mass trauma phases? There is a great deal of disagreement in general in the academia and also in the research world about these two issues. Let's talk for a moment about complex emergencies, which is a new construct used to describe situations of disrupted livelihoods and threats to life produced by warfare, by civil disturbance, and large-scale exodus of people, resulting in excess mortality. We know that, and that's maybe one of the features that is emerging in the literature as complex emergencies, in which any emergency response has to be conducted in a difficult, often turbulent, political and security environment. Our program of global trauma and global health is involved precisely in those environments of complex emergencies, working in 4 countries, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Guatemala and Peru. And I will show a little bit about that at the very end of this presentation. In complex emergencies, it is civilian populations which are the main target. This is a growing concern. Out of the total number of casualties, 9 out of 10, and possibly more than 9 now, if we look at the experience of Iraq and the Central Asia conflict in Afghanistan, 9 of 10 casualties are civilians. They're not military personnel engaged into this. So civilian populations are the ones who are carrying the death toll, the largest part of the death toll, and also the psychological trauma evolving from or emerging from this exposure. There's an excess mortality as direct or indirect effects of war, and this has been arbitrarily set by Toole and Waldman in a piece of work that was published in the 90s, early 90s, in sub-Saharan Africa, of one death of crude, or a rate equal or above a crude mortality rate of one death per 10,000 people per day. Central Africa, Congo, for instance, has about 43.2 deaths per 10,000 per day due to violence. And that gives you a clear indication of, and you can compare in between countries within the sub-Saharan region, this figure as a kind of a threshold, very important to keep in mind. Infectious diseases and malnutrition are responsible for a large segment of this excess mortality. It's not only physical violence, but also the accompanying infectious diseases and malnutrition, which is compounding the whole phenomenon. The psychological dimension is often, if not always, underplayed in these complex emergencies, and the interventions are aimed mostly to reduce this threshold of crude mortality rates of 1 per 10,000 per day, with little provision for mental health or psychosocial support. I want to refer only to one at the bottom of this slide, the lack of evidence of inadequate evidence on effectiveness of existing therapies for PTSD. A recent study by the Institute of Medicine published in last year, in 2008, out of 2,771 studies that were reviewed in the literature, they retain only 37 as valid studies of RCT, or randomized clinical trials made with pharmacotherapy, and 52 on psychotherapy. And the bad news is that none of this seems to work. And the evidence is either lacking or it's inadequate evidence of these therapies to be effective in the management of post-traumatic stress disorder, for instance. There is a new context for humanitarian interventions which is drawn from an altered epidemiological profile. For instance, the new complex emergencies emerging, the presence of new actors in the, on the intervention scene, apart from the UN agencies that were much generated or emerging after the Second World War and in the early 80s for refugees and so on. It's now the NGOs and the military who are also new actors in this intervention scene. A growing demand for closer scrutiny on the quality and performance of humanitarian interventions is omnipresent. And finally, the recognition of the incompleteness or inadequacy of our knowledge of what should be done when confronted with a humanitarian crisis. In conclusion, the interrelations between violence, trauma, and collective health are non-linear and more complex than we expected. After 9/11, PTSD adopts a new identity as a phenomenon of epidemic proportions, from which new forms of PTSD seem to evolve: virtual PTSD, distance trauma, tertiary trauma, etc. Actually, trauma is invading the diagnostic and the statistics manuals of the American Psychiatry Association. In the last edition, the version number 4, neurosis has disappeared as an entity, but trauma has come back as with a vengeance, because it's almost everything in the world of psychiatric practice today led by this issue of trauma. However, we need to be cautious looking at the consequences of violence and responses to war and natural disasters through a Western lens. PTSD is not the only health outcome, and recovery may not be the result of a simple enterprise. That is more or less the conceptual framework which we have evolved in the Trauma and Global Health Program, which is now at McGill, housed at McGill. And as I said, we have partnerships with 4 different countries who have joined us in this new program. We are receiving funding from the Global Health Research Initiative, the Thiessen-Corti Team Program. In fact, we are one of the 13 programs worldwide based in Canada, and the project is led at the Douglas Mental Health University Institute and McGill University. I invite you, those of you who are interested in looking at the research, capacity building, and knowledge transfer set of activities that we entertain with these 4 countries, are well described in this webpage. Both the people involved, the fellowships, there is a resource center in both English and Spanish. There are notes from the field and other interesting materials. Actually, I should acknowledge the presence in this audience of the coordinator of this program, Consuelo Razzuris, sitting at the table, and also the administrator or the manager of this web page, Tamsin Farr, who is also sitting there. This is just a brief abstract of what is the project all about. For those of you who are interested, you can either speak to the people that I've just pointed at in the break, or to me, or to anybody of our group in the few minutes to come. Thank you.